It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We've been checking in with Wisconsin's congressional delegation, and today we hear from Democratic Representative Mark Pocan.
Pocan has introduced a bill that seeks to ban special government employees, in particular Elon Musk, from obtaining federal contracts. Yesterday, the House DOGE subcommittee met for the first time.
House Democrats took aim at Musk's Department of Government Efficiency initiative, while Republicans fiercely defended Musk's actions, even as federal judges are attempting to stop some of them.
Here's Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Georgia Republican who is the DOGE subcommittee chair.
The legislative branch can't sit on the sidelines. In this subcommittee, we will fight the war on waste shoulder to shoulder with President Trump, Elon Musk, and the DOGE team.
Representative Mark Pocan joins us now to discuss his latest policy initiative and other issues facing Democrats. Representative Pocan, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You don't sit on the House DOGE subcommittee, but do you have takeaways from what you heard yesterday?
Well, Congress isn't doing a damn thing. To be honest, that's part of the problem. We've pretty much given up our constitutional authority as a branch of government and given the keys completely to the executive branch. And the president has given the keys completely to an unelected billionaire and a bunch of 19 to 20 somethings who are working for the DOGE commission that are now turning on and off the spigots of federal dollars. The problem is they have no experience or understanding of what they're doing. And we're seeing real life impacts back home. We're seeing farmers that can't have their products sold to USAID anymore to give food around the world. We're finding up our researchers who are going to lose their grants and lose their jobs and lose years of potential work through those items that they're researching. We're finding out about people who have disabilities on Medicaid who are very fearful that they're not going to have the support that they need. And then that falls on the community. We're hearing about cuts to Department of Education so deep that it's going to affect the overall dollars that are available, which is going to then cut every district in the state. At the same time, they're trying to move those dollars to private schools. There's a lot going on, but Congress isn't doing a thing about it. And that's part of the problem. Right now, you literally just have an unelected billionaire and some 20-somethings, none of which have any experience in the federal government. And to make it worse, Elon Musk has federal contracts, $20 billion plus he's had, plus some undisclosed ones. Look, a member of Congress can't have a contract with federal government for good reason. Federal employees can't have a contract, separate contract, with the federal government where they have oversight. But Elon Musk somehow has that. And honestly, that's like a formula for corruption when you are in charge of turning on the spigots of federal dollars. So there's a lot of problems going on where I work right now.
You've introduced legislation known as the Elon Musk Act. Musk, as you have mentioned, a major federal contractor. What would this do?
Well, it's the eliminate looting of our nation by mitigating unethical state kleptocracy, which also stands for Elon Musk. But the point is, he is now a special government employee, no different really than a federal employee or a member of Congress, and should abide by the same rules, which means you can't also get federal contracts because you're just ripe for corruption. I mean, you know, if a federal agency right now, he's proving it by shutting some down. If you want to make sure you're not hurt, guess what? Maybe you find a contract for one of his companies. That is the definition of corruption, and that's what we're doing right now. And unless we have something that either says he can't have contracts, but he can then have the role he's in, or he can't have the role he's in if he wants federal contracts. But to do both, clearly, doesn't matter where you come from on the political spectrum, doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense for members of Congress. It doesn't make sense for other federal employees. It shouldn't make any sense for special government employees.
Is your legislation getting any traction with your colleagues?
Well, I think the messaging is, you know, because now and more people are figuring out that he has a lot of contracts. And it just turns out that he now has access to all this data, including a lot of our privacy data across the country. But he has data to the people who have made complaints against his companies at SpaceX and Elon Tesla. And that's a problem, right? And, you know, a lot of these agencies are actually investigating parts of the contracts they had because you do that to protect taxpayer resources. And now he's able to influence those. So there is so much corruption right now, potential with this DOGE commission that, you know, I don't think was thought of. Donald Trump was infamous for saying on healthcare, he had a concept of a plan, not a plan. Pretty much everything he does is a concept of a plan. But the reality is putting the world's richest man who gets federal contracts in charge of federal dollars that could go to federal contracts is a real problem. And don't forget also, the cuts that he's making are all about the tax cut for the wealthiest, for Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg.
Congressman
Buchanan, holy grail.
Yeah, I do want to ask you, though. I mean, you've listed a laundry list of items here that the Trump administration and Elon Musk are moving on. It's fast. What else are House Democrats doing as this transpires with government agencies and federal offices? Do Democrats know how to respond in this moment?
Well, elections have consequences. We're not in charge of the House, the Senate, or the executive branch. So if there's a government shutdown, for example, on March 14th, it's because the Republicans have decided to do that. They're in charge of everything. And I am fearful that that will likely happen. In fact, I think Donald Trump loves the drama. He might just do that. We're working on two fronts, litigation, and we often can't have standing because Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, won't give us that standing to sue. So we're working with the groups that are suing on many of these actions that we think are illegal or even unconstitutional. And then communication. We're trying to get the information out right now. I think if the average person, doesn't matter who you voted for, but if you voted for Donald Trump because eggs and housing were too expensive, I understand why you might have done that. But if you think having someone who can then get federal contracts from controlling federal agencies, you might not like that. Or if you think that cuts to the Department of Education could actually take tax dollars, resources away from education, that they're going to fall in on your property taxes, it's just a bait and switch, you may not like that. And I think our job is to get that kind of information out.
Talking with Representative Mark Pocan, serves Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, learning about how he and other Democrats are responding to the new presidential administration. We talked recently with your colleague across the aisle, Republican Representative Tom Tiffany was here, talking about President Trump's federal funding freeze and whether that violates Congress's power of the purse. Let's hear what he had to say.
I believe it's appropriate that this administration is saying, hold it. Time out. We want to make sure that this money is going to appropriate purposes. So did we appropriate the money? Yes, we did. But it is up to the executive branch to make sure that the money is going out in a fashion that represents the will of the American people.
Do you think the president has the right to freeze federal funding? And if not, how would Congress challenge it?
Well, it's very apparent Tom Tiffany doesn't serve on the Appropriations Committee like I do, because he would have a better answer than that. We almost exclusively have the power of the purse, and there may be some areas where the executive branch does. But if funds have already been appropriated, that's part of the beef, right, with where he's going and how much overreach you're seeing from the White House, which is why there's many lawsuits right now. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think there's just a complete lack of understanding by the White House where some of their authority is. So when they're going into these federal agencies, including ones that are created by Congress, which they don't have the authority to go in and dismantling them, that's something that there's absolutely going to be litigation. Very likely they're going to be stopped. But in the meantime, there's confusion and chaos, unfortunately something that Donald Trump enjoys too often. But at least as a member of Congress, what we have to care about is our constitutional authority and our constitutional powers. And too many of these members of Congress, including Tom Tiffany, apparently, are willing to give the keys to Congress, also to the White House, and that takes away the checks and balances we need.
Okay, you mentioned earlier March 14th. Congress has until that date to pass a government spending bill and prevent a government shutdown. Could this be a moment for Democrats to flesh out a deal with Republicans as what we see, as you mentioned earlier, Trump dismantling federal agencies? Is there a moment that you could see some working together?
Well, traditionally, that's the way it would be. The Republicans, however, last Congress were very clear that they were going to get the votes from their caucus or else they wouldn't do it at all. And very rare occasion did they break from that. And if that's the way they're going to operate, which we think they will, since they're in charge of the House and the Senate and the White House, I think it's going to be very difficult to see them with their somewhat dysfunctional majority, especially in the House, being able to do something. And they had two deals last year with Democrats, one just in December with Mike Johnson, where they broke an agreement we made, and the year prior with Kevin McCarthy, which had never happened since I've been in Congress prior. So it's a little hard to trust people when you have a negotiation and agreement and they break it, that, you know, it's going to have to be something consequential because they're doing, I think, a lot of damage right now and overreach of their power. and verifiable, because we now have had several broken agreements from this current majority in the Congress. So it's always possible, but I think more likely Donald Trump loves theater. He loves drama. Every person who is a cabinet pick had to submit video of them on TV, because that's how he operates. And for him, it's entertaining to have a shutdown. I would bet there's going to be a shutdown.
Representative Pocan, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries unveiled this 10-part plan last week for House Democrats to counter many of Trump's moves. Where do you stand on a plan like this?
Well, I already said it's litigation and communication, right? Unfortunately, we don't have the majority in Congress to actually pass legislation. So we're working with the groups on the outside, and I urge everyone to support those groups. There's trackers out there about all the litigation, and there's a lot right now on Trump's actions. But communication, share, you know, there's so many falsehoods that, especially Elon Musk, because he has no clue about how the federal government works. We have to share that information so people can see just how dangerous some of their actions are, because they don't know it and they don't understand it. But just our privacy alone, our data. You know, recently Elon Musk was talking about federal employees, how could they have such high net worths with their salary? Well, how would he even know that unless he's really looking at people's data a little too closely? And with the Treasury, he has information about our Social Security payments, our taxes, everything across the country. That is big government at its worst. And I think people have to kind of wake up and realize that, you know, this is a power grab like we have never seen before.
Representative Pocan, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Mark Pocan is the U.S. representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. That includes Madison. We've been checking in with Wisconsin's delegation on Capitol Hill in recent weeks to discuss the latest developments. You can listen back to these interviews at WPR.org.
Coming up, a Wisconsin researcher shares a new project that could answer questions about some of the earliest life on the planet.
The whole point of this research is to understand how life persisted across catastrophes, dramatic shifts.
That's coming up here on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. UW-Madison researchers are kicking off a project that studies an enzyme that could help explain the origins of life on Earth.
Funded by a grant from the Keck Foundation, the research team is looking at nitrogenase, which helps bacteria collect nitrogen, a vital ingredient in, you know, life.
The lead researcher joins us now for a look at the project and how it fits into wider questions of the development and survival of living organisms.
Betul Kachar is an associate professor of bacteriology at UW-Madison and director of the Kachar Lab. Betul, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this new research now, a particular enzyme that's used in, well, in living, I guess, is the main point of it. Tell us about this enzyme and why it's so important to us.
The enzyme under scope is called nitrogenase. It's an enzyme that enabled a lot of the innovations that we see around us today in terms of what the planet enabled. I must say that we are interested in the past, and we are interested in understanding not necessarily what has failed, but what has worked and what worked best under a specific set of conditions. And particularly for this enzyme, this research is about exploring its origins, its evolution, its journey across time, and simply asking ourselves, how are you here after 3 billion years of survival on this planet?
Right. This nitrogenase has been around a long time. What were some of the first organisms, as far as we can tell, that developed this enzyme?
Ooh, that's a very, very important question. When it comes to the earliest stages of life, it's very difficult to understand exactly what the composition of these organisms were, how they look like. But we can extrapolate their behavior based on the rock record and the remnants that we can extract from the rocks and attribute them to certain behavior. When I say that life is really old, I'm talking about 4 billion years. Mm-hmm. So that's good for any of us that feel extremely old these days, that we are actually much younger compared to what life has gone through here. And 4 billion years is we should consider it as 4 billion years of living experience. And the whole point of this research is to understand how life persisted across catastrophes, dramatic shifts. I'm talking changes in the atmosphere, shifts in temperature, changes in oceanic pH, big volcanic eruptions, big fluctuations. How did this enzyme in particular and many other organisms persist? And we are particularly interested in this from not just for the sake of understanding, of course, but how can we distill this information for the benefit of the greater society, for the benefit of our own good?
Yeah, this nitrogenase for those early forms of life and still today is doing something really important. It's taking nitrogen out of the environment. We all need some nitrogen, right, to survive as organisms. And it's not an easy thing for a life form to do. I can't just go out and grab nitrogen out of the atmosphere. Why is this such an important task in the early development of life and to modern agriculture and nutrition?
Yeah, so this is a very important question. That indeed, nitrogenase, this enzyme, is a critical component of the Earth's biosphere, and it's been so for over 3 billion years. Even though it is abundant in the atmosphere on Earth, it's about 80%, only one enzyme can fix nitrogen, meaning only one enzyme can make it biologically useful, usable, and which really acts as a gateway for life to access this element. We rely on microbes, organisms that we cannot see with naked eye, to do this for us. You can think of them as engines of life. Microbes take this abundant form in the atmosphere and fix it into a usable form for all other organisms, usually by way of plants also, through their relationship that they formed also a really long time ago. Nitrogen is a very important element. It is present in our DNA. It is present in our cells. It is present in ATP, in the form of energy. So we therefore really need this for our own existence.
So parking in modern agriculture for a minute, I hear people talking about, okay, we can plant legumes, beans, and some other plants to fix nitrogen in the soil. When they're doing that, that is using nitrogenase. Is that right?
It is through nitrogenase as well as other components that help nitrogenase to do its job. Cells are very cooperative, right? There's a lot of parts that are interacting with each other within cells. Nitrogenase is definitely a key player, but there's a lot going on within these living systems that actually help this star of the show, so to speak, to do its job. This is very important for agriculture, of course, especially when it comes to higher production, more effective production under fluctuating environmental conditions. We will have to make smart decisions about our own bioengineering ideas and our own new technological developments when it comes to mitigating the immediate crises that are waiting our planet and how our crops and pretty much everything that we rely on in order to feed ourselves will be affected. It will come down to understanding this enzyme, and it will come down to making it more resilient to enable its persistence under very challenging conditions.
Now let's turn back to the clock, that 4-ish billion years ago. As you look for information about nitrogenase and other early evidence of life on our planet, what kind of evidence remains after all that time?
You would be surprised how stable some of the remnants of early systems can be. We travel to unusual places on Earth. These could be extreme environments, and these could be regular environments that just take a long time to travel, like Australia, and access these fossils that are also representative of really ancient microbes. By studying them, we get a sense of not only how the early life looks like, but also how our planet was. billions of years ago. This is important. This is a journey of ourselves. As old as humans have been, as long as we have developed consciousness, we wanted to know our place in the universe. And without a doubt, understanding our place in the universe will necessitate understanding of our own past and history. And nothing is more fundamental than life and its own origin and story itself on this planet.
Now, if I'm a 4-billion-year-old bacteria and I have nitrogenase and I'm you know, transferring nitrogen from the atmosphere, say, into myself, well, I'm helping myself, am I starting the basics of a food chain where other organisms, maybe without this enzyme, are using some of that nitrogen that I fixed using this enzyme?
So let's get the record straight. First of all, we don't know whether the earliest life actually had a nitrogenase 4 billion years ago. We know that nitrogen can be fixed, meaning it could be made available for life through completely non-living phenomena like lightning. Lightning can produce fixed nitrogen. The problem is that it is not sufficient. So we think that the early organisms and early ecosystems with the increased amount and increased complexity necessitated a response from biology. And thankfully, biology responded to this through this amazing enzyme that actually is able to now fix nitrogen much more efficiently than lightning or the planetary system itself can. So you're looking at a section where, you know, you can get this sort of fixation or availability through geology, but at some point you fall off a cliff, and that's when biology responds. And so nitrogenase and this enzyme in particular, like many other examples out there, is a great example, really, of how the planet is able to respond to demands of the environment. So we are looking at a complex ecosystem. You're looking at a lot of microbes, but Earth, again, is very different. We don't have the land like we know it. We don't have soils. We don't have plants. We think early planet was pretty much an oceanic system with a lot of microbial activity. So microbes are not only our true ancestors, but they are really the true owners of this planet. I like to think that if you don't like microbes, you are living on the wrong planet.
We're talking about new research into life's origins with Betul Kachar, Associate Professor of Bacteriology at UW-Madison. Betul, when I've talked to you in the past, you're looking at Earth's distant history, right, the origins of life here, but you're also looking at possible evidence for, you know, what we're looking for if we're trying to find life on other planets. What kind of things are we learning from our origins on Earth that's helping us look at wherever else in the solar system we can look at?
We are absolutely very interested in helping NASA and other studies looking for life and signs of life elsewhere in the universe, starting with our solar system. And there's no better guide than our own past and our own history. The punchline here, and I hope that I really want the listeners to take this from me, that our own ancient planet itself is an alien place. It's different. Its temperature is different. Its biota is different. Everything about it is different. In fact, you and I wouldn't be able to survive on this planet. Yet we know life survived. It thrived, in fact, in these environments. So one of the main reasons also why we are so interested in understanding early life and evolution is also to assist studies for looking for life elsewhere in the universe. And in fact, for instance, when we look at our nearest cousin, sister planet Mars, our understanding the history of our own planet becomes extremely important. That Mars creates a great comparison point. It's almost, you can imagine, a planet that is arrested in development. It captures our own planet's past really well. So by studying Mars and comparing it with our own present life and its own past, we are going to be gaining more insights as to what enables life's survival and what will enable its own sustenance in the future.
I understand you and your team last year published a cookbook of recipes and ingredients, not for our kitchen, but that could be the sparks for life on a planet, or I guess a moon or what have you. How many recipes are there potentially for creating life?
Well, more than we think is, and that's our publication, more than we think there are recipes. I think there are a lot of lost recipes too. So life is a form of chemistry, right? I like to think that this is the only place where you can study biology, planet Earth. You can study chemistry pretty much every other planet, but this is the only place where we can be a biologist. And interestingly, biology is also a form of chemistry. The biology is chemistry with memory. It retained its memory for billions of years, and it is able to respond to its environment. It's able to come up with solutions in the face of challenges. So understanding origin of life becomes a very big biotechnology problem. It is not necessarily understanding how it happened at first place, but how could happen and what is the capability of life given the environment, given the choice. In our paper, we suggested that, and we've shown that as well, that the early chemistry and the early chemical diversity of this planet could enable variety of different pathways for life and early metabolisms to take place. And these chemistries are very well present on different planets within our solar system and beyond.
I wanted to ask you about the idea of detecting life, because it seems like there's a good chance that if we were somehow to encounter life on another planet, maybe in our solar system, it wouldn't walk up to us and say hi. It might be a slight statistical variation in chemical compositions that points to the evidence of life. How hard could it be to find life, even if it is out there?
This is one of the most exciting times, I think, for us to be asking this question. We absolutely need technology in order to assist our own pursuit for life, right? We need to be able to observe. For that, we need high-resolution telescopes. We need to be able to visit these places. For that, we need a more effective, affordable way of doing so. And we need to guide our exploration through science. So this is, again, when all these three criteria got together in this very time. That's why I think the future is incredibly exciting when it comes to exploring our own place in the universe. The thing about microbes, and that's what makes them exciting and important, is that they are able to shape the color of the planet as well. As you said, we are not looking for someone waving back at us. Well, unless, you know, maybe according to Hollywood, yes, because I guess it will be hard to find microbial actors. Humans still make better actors. But when it comes to understanding a planet, the color and the composition of the atmosphere, the gases, and what is really going to create that sign of, hey, look at me, there's something really interesting going on here, is going to come through the understanding of the diversity of microbes on this planet and what it is capable of. And that's why I think search for life is a very exciting field. It is really an exciting marriage between technology and basic science. It leads to different technologies, but it also leads to ever more interesting questions that we did not even know how to ask regarding life we have here on this planet.
A common theme in science fiction, and I think a more scientific thought now, is the idea that, okay, if we can get to another planet without life, we could potentially terraform it, create the conditions for life on it. You did a talk at one point, I'm not sure how far back, not just asking could we, but also should we, looking at sort of the ethics of terraforming, of creating life on a new planet. What are some of the things you think about?
The idea is to understand the planet for what it is, and that's where the research is at the moment. For us to understand the chemistry that led to life on this planet, that this is why it becomes extremely important. Astrobiologists like to ask themselves, and we study these problems, what is the chemical cocktail that I need for creating any interesting chemistries in the lab that could have its own sustainability over long time periods? What sort of chemical composition should a planet have, for example, for it to give birth to life as we know it? And the idea then should be to truly understand the planet prior, or maybe even way before, and without even thinking about what sort of similar life forms we can carry to this place, we should understand the planets for what they are and treat their own conditions and try to understand and integrate their own histories when we study their chemistries.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, we can only study biology right now on planet Earth. You made the choice to ask these questions and do this work in Wisconsin, here in Wisconsin at UW-Madison. Why here?
I'm extremely happy to be here, especially the investment of Wisconsin and the interest within the state, and especially rooted through the Wisconsin idea that the understanding science for the sake of humanity and for the greater service is very important. Especially considering the huge history of Wisconsin when it comes to agriculture and nitrogen fixation and understanding the basic properties of nitrogen fixation. There's almost over a century old history here in Madison. But at the same time, we have a very exciting Origin of Life community here that is composed of chemistry, astronomy, geosciences, as well as microbiology. A lot of different researchers that happened to come here over the last decade that I think created a really amazing hotbed for this sort of work to propel forward. And I'm really excited to be a part of it. And I'm very grateful for the support.
As we wrap up, Betul, what's the timeline now for this nitrogenase research? It's early days. What's the schedule?
Yes, with two other colleagues from the Department of Bacteriology and Chemical Engineering, we are going to be scaling our biotechnological forces. We have a very exciting team of graduate students, undergraduates, postdoctoral researchers, and staff researchers involved. It's a big team. This sort of big ideas seldom work alone, right? Science is a very collaborative process. And we have about 3-4 years ahead of us in order to bring this to fruition. But of course, we are very ambitious and we want to get there sooner. And hopefully I will be in touch with you also regarding our exciting results very soon.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Betul Kachara is an associate professor of bacteriology at UW-Madison. Been talking about her work on the origins of life on Earth and what it can mean for the search for life elsewhere.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a new book highlights Racine union leaders who fought for a more inclusive working class community decades ago with impacts today.
The energy coming out of Racine can really shape what's happening in the state of Wisconsin, what's happening in the United States.
The author of the book, A Blueprint for Worker Solidarity, that's next from WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new book about Racine's union and working class history highlights key lessons from the picket lines decades ago. From strikes at Case, the agricultural equipment maker in the 1950s, to manufacturing plant closures and mass layoffs of the 1980s.
Author Naomi R. Williams shows how Racine maintained a strong labor movement, resisting trends seen in other Midwestern factory towns.
Naomi is an assistant professor of labor studies and employment relations at Rutgers University. Their new book is called A Blueprint for Worker Solidarity, Class Politics and Community in Wisconsin. We spoke last month.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Communities around Wisconsin have long histories in organizing and unions. Why did you focus on Racine?
I was really excited about a story I heard about it from the 1970s. 1976, SEIU Local 150 members went on strike at the hospital in Racine. And the pictures in the newspaper in the Racine Labor showed these black and brown women on the picket line. And then you had these white UAW workers behind them. And that story, that picture, those images in Racine Labor were so different than the stories that, we typically hear about labor in the 1970s. And so I wanted to know more about it.
You lay out for us how Racine really is able to overcome some of these racial divisions and build a more inclusive union, a more inclusive working class community. Could you give us a story about one of the faces of this movement?
probably the person I go to the most to talk about the racial politics is William Jenkins. Mm. He had a long life, a long period of activism in the city. He moved to Racine as a young child, grew up there, went to high school, and started working at one of the foundries. And just his experiences in town and the fact that he was a sports star and lots of folks knew who he was, and he came from a union background, and he was really committed to racial justice and to worker organizing. And he just led the way through so many relationships and building community in terms of introducing folks to each other and standing up for those with less power than he had, and always making sure that he was a voice of reason. And his activism really just spread through his UAW local. He was very active in the Racine NAACP and those dual roles. Mm-hmm. Really just create space, right? Create space for people to ask questions and get involved and feel seen.
It strikes me, reading about Blue Jenkins, who I've never encountered before, he really helped people get established in the community and, as you say, really be seen and just help get their needs met as they moved to the area.
Exactly. His family was, their house was really close to the train station. Mm-hmm. And so as Black folks were migrating from Southern cities to Northern and Western cities, they often looked for those types of connections to find out, okay, where's a safe place to live? You know, who's hiring folks that look like me? How can I get established? Things like that. And so his family was sort of a gateway for Black people coming into Racine during, the early to mid 1900s.
You also explore the relationship between Racine's labor community and activists like Corrine Reed Owens, who, from what I understand, also was such a driving force in the area. Can you talk about her contribution?
Yeah, the Rosa Parks of Racine.
Yes.
Right? She's a remarkable figure. And unfortunately, you know, these people passed away before I had a chance to interview them. But reading about them and talking to people who knew them, you really see the impact that they had in the community. She was an educator, and she was kept out of the classroom for a long time. But she was really active in education in Racine and really got involved with YWCA and civic organizations and community organizations around housing justice. And so she led a march in Racine to get a Fair Housing Act passed so that Black folks could receive better access to safe and comfortable housing in the city.
Those that really resonates today. And you also found that union leaders would really try to create more inclusive atmospheres and gain the support of all workers. What was it like for women in the community in organizing and in unions?
For one of the things, I'm going to back up a little bit. One of the things that really impressed me about labor organizing in the city is the wide breadth of organizations or businesses and workplaces that were unionized. There was a really active garment workers union, and a lot of women were there. A lot of women were in bookbinding, and there were women spread out in different industrial workplaces. And in fact, there were so many organized working women in Racine that during the 1930s, 1940s, they actually had softball teams that they could play against each other. And just the sheer volume of organized women in the city really opened the door to understanding that everybody belonged in the union movement. And women were very active in their own unions, really demanding respect. They went to very early AFL-CIO conventions, demanding to have a voice in decision-making. And when there were statewide conventions, women workers would make sure that their voices were heard in those spaces as well. And then they actively sought to, so it wasn't perfect. So I'll stop there and say it wasn't a perfect situation, right? But women actively said, this is what we need and this is what we're looking for. And so that just a publicness of the work that they were doing really went a long way in making a difference. So there was a woman on the board for the labor organizations in the county, and just having a seat at the table makes a big difference.
We're talking about Racine's working class history with Naomi R. Williams, an assistant professor of labor studies and employment relations at Rutgers University. The new book is called A Blueprint for Worker Solidarity. Naomi, can you step back and give us a sense of the impact of Local 180, the members of Racine's United Auto Workers? It was, at the time you're writing this book, the largest union in the city in the post-war 60s to 80s. What made this chapter so special?
Yeah, so they worked at Case, all right, Case Manufacturing Plant. They work at Case, right? Local 180 still exists in Racine.
The really large ag manufacturing equipment manufacturer, yeah.
Right, yes. So for me, what was really exciting about what they were doing is they always had to fight for what other UAW locals were getting at the bargaining table with management at Case. Case management was really resistant to give up anything of what they call management prerogative, right? And the workers at Case constantly, bargaining session after bargaining session, had to fight for what was at the time, for example, the 1950s, right? Just basic standard contract language. And it wasn't the case at Case. And so there's a great quote from William Jenkins in his interview from the 1970s, where he says, thinking back on what made the energy in Racine so intense, he was like, you know, it was the workers at Case, and they had to fight, and that labor strife that they dealt with year after year really kept us motivated, kept us focused on making gains and holding on to those gains. And it was a large local. They're really involved in the community, right? And so in this time period, they talked about it as a total person unionism, your responsibility to your coworkers, your union members, but also to your community. And so how are you getting involved in local politics? How are you getting involved in charity? And what's your responsibility as a union member? And really living that. And then you had leaders like Tony Vallejo, who, and Harvey Kitzman. I should start with Harvey Kitzman, actually. And really just this broad view, working together with folks like William Jenkins and Tony Vallejo to kind of shape a narrative about the responsibility of Racine's workers to make Racine the best city in Wisconsin.
What stands out to me, and I think you said it in Tony Vallejo, who was going door to door, was going to workplaces to explain to workers why unions were valuable. And it seems like it was such a grassroots human approach. Is there a thread in that to where you might see Racine today?
I think it is. He was one of the folks that set the example for labor activists coming after him of, okay, you're doing your work at the job site in your union, but also in the community, and then retiring and moving into the broader UAW position, right? So he becomes an international representative. And so he's representing members across UAW locals in the city, in the county, in the district, and really just trying to make sure that everybody understood what was going on during contract negotiations at their particular workplace, if there's an organizing drive, really wanting to make sure that workers understood what was at stake. And also being involved in community organizations, right? So understanding that it's not just what happens at work, but people need safe places to live. People need to be able to afford to pay their utility bills. They need access to insurance, right? Mm-hmm. And so being really involved in those types of issues in the city, I think, is an example for us. And it's part of the reason why the book is called A Blueprint for Worker Solidarity, because there are so many models of things that we can do today, just talking to our neighbors, understanding what their issues are, and then pointing them to the labor movement as a way to answer some of the things that they need.
Yes. In your conclusion, you write that the Racine labor community and the broader labor movement lost, and that felt jarring. It felt so final. What are you trying to say there?
Yeah, so they didn't lose, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe I should have worded that a little bit different. They did everything right, but workers can't. This isn't something that we as workers can do by ourselves. Mm-hmm. We need an active, engaged government, right? Who's going to help keep our bargaining playing field level? Right now, corporate interests, you know, have the bar tilted toward them. But it's also super inspiring to me the ways more and more people are returning to this idea of class solidarity and getting involved with unions. It's so inspiring to see what Walmart workers and Starbucks workers and art museums workers and librarians and adjunct faculty, graduate students, the ways that folks are coming together and seeing themselves in common cause with each other and really celebrating all of the ways that we are different and how those differences can help us unite and have a real multiracial working class movement for economic justice. And I think that really that the conclusion is a call to policymakers and to scholars to really narrate the stories of the past differently. And to not take away people's power and to really showcase like what does work at a local level and how that can transform at the national level.
That what you do locally can have such great ripple effects well beyond Racine or whatever community you live in.
Exactly, exactly. When folks are talking about Wisconsin and national politics, right, places like Racine matter. Mm-hmm. And the energy coming out of Racine can really shape, right, what's happening in the state of Wisconsin, what's happening in the United States more broadly. And understanding the complexity of that story matters for the decisions that we make.
Naomi, thank you for sharing your research. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's very exciting to talk with you today.
And that was Naomi R. Williams, who is an assistant professor of labor studies and employment relations at Rutgers University. The book is called A Blueprint for Worker Solidarity, Class Politics and Community in Wisconsin. They talked with us about how workers in Racine built up unions and a more inclusive working class community decades ago and the people who fought for workers' rights.
And if you have a story from your community that you'd like more research on, you'd like to hear it told, well, let us know about it. You can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Your Wisconsin-made music suggestions keep flowing our way, so let's keep it going.
Jamie in Algoma writes, first, blues guitarist Dale Anderson of Green Bay, who Jamie met in the 90s.
And the band is called the Delta Jets, and Dale Anderson is a composer as well.
Next on Jamie's list, check out Victoria Vox, also of Green Bay, who can really rock a ukulele.
And finally, a trio from Milwaukee that plays fantastic Irish music. They're called Ahas.
Jamie, thanks so much for this list. Now you can add to it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232.
that we love to sample your Wisconsin music. And thanks for being part of Wisconsin Today.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.